connecting to the internet.
Internet.
Networking software.
World Wide Web for web.
Computer today.
Computer.
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 NetSurfer Pro.
Hello.
Hello.
Listeners of NetSurfer Pro. This is NetSurfer Pro, a whirlwind ride through the World Wide Web. However, I guess this is technically a talk surfer.
Yeah, unfortunately, the net is currently down everywhere. There's no new net news, unfortunately. We're in a no net November sort of situation, except it's not even November. So, you know, it's just sort of no net now.
There's no net now.
There's no net now.
I'm sorry to say. Yeah, so this is actually a talk surfer show.
Which is a whirlwind ride through whatever we want, starring your host this week, Galen, and my co-host, as always, for Talk Surfers,
Matthew Marissa. And so you may have seen that there's sort of a wave currently of internet media creators and artists realizing that they don't have to do this their entire life, that they will eventually die, and thus they should find a time for their channels to, close up as well.
Not us, though.
Not
We're
us,
never
though.
Going to. We're never going to die.
Yeah. So we may never die. However, we do have some changes being made. We're not ending the podcast. We're not retiring. But we are sort of taking this time to recenter ourselves and look a bit inward at our schedules and our release and stuff like that, as well as changes in schedules that are upcoming. As far as, like, having time to record in everything. So,
yes.
Essentially, what our current plan is to every month do one Talk Surfer or, like, a smaller episode along the lines of, like, the Pinball episode or the Civ 6 episode. One that doesn't really require as much research. It is more opinion-based. And then every month as well, we will have one main episode, which is sort of the normal Net Surfer Pro affair with research and fact cornering and sort of more in-depth constructed arguments. This will give us better time to prepare and, like, you know, really research and look into things, and also just more time to accurately present our thoughts, and hopefully will not lead to year four burnout.
Yeah. Year four, which we are now calling year fortnight, because there's going to be a new episode every fortnight. There's no other reason.
That's pretty good, actually.
Yeah.
That's actually pretty good.
I'm pretty
that's
happy
That's actually
with that
pretty
one.
Good. Yeah, that's clever. You know what?
I told a good joke. I have to go out to the world and tell everyone.
You know what? You deserve a cheesy roll-up.
I can't believe it.
That's like my dog treat. Like Scoob. I think like Velma's changing our Scooby snacks for cheesy roll-ups.
Like Scoob, I think that Velma's sneaking in our medication and the cheese that she feeds us. Well, I don't know, Raggy, it's real rasty. Anyway.
Rasty cheese.
Rasty Reese.
So, though, as sort of it is a internet topic that's kind of been bouncing around a lot, we are of course going to talk about sort of the it's not really a retirement wave. Here's the thing, I feel like a lot of people are viewing this as a mass retirement.
Yeah,
I think there's some big names, and then a lot of people are reacting to those big names, and so the people reacting to it seem to be larger than the people doing it.
Yeah, it's, yeah, the you've got a couple of notable names. MatPat is probably the biggest that would be more relevant to us. Tom Scott certainly is extremely relevant and has been doing this for over a decade. However, MatPat sort of has the cultural kind of meme presence that we tend to focus on.
Tom Scott has a lot of meme presence.
Tom Scott does,
especially
have a lot
in
of
the
meme
past
presence.
Like 2 or 3 years. I think, like, the I am here has been sort of a big meme for a few years now.
As has a Knop it Ah.
Yeah. And so, like, people have really sort of taken to Tom Scott as far as memehood. There's already plays on that meme and sort of deconstructions of it, which is really great. I wouldn't say that it's necessarily, like, MatPat does have, I think, more memehood. In that MatPat is almost more of a meme character than Tom Scott.
Yes.
I think MatPat is more controversial by also a large margin. Tom Scott doesn't really invite controversy, whereas like MatPat kind of has a habit of it. MatPat, Game Theory, all the other spinoffs of that, very controversial in that, like, A, his theories are not great a lot of times. B, sullies the reputation of John Conway. Was that his name? Was it John? John Conway?
The Game of Life gentleman?
Yeah.
Yes, John Conway. John Way, as he is sometimes known.
Yeah, of John Conway and other game theory mathematicians. C, I don't know. Okay, so I watched it at first. Like, I remember as a kid liking some of the game theory episodes. Like, the Minecraft one where it's like, how heavy would diamond armor be?
Yeah.
Like, that's a good one. The Mega Man one where it's like, Wily is the, or of Dr. Light's the real villain because he violates the laws of robotics is at least like an interesting look into sort of the ramifications of AI and how that is reflected in the Mega Man series. But then like Mario is the real villain is a really dumb one. And that's not even to mention like the Pyro one, which is full of stereotypes that are really bad.
Yeah, it's MatPat has a history of some controversy, and like some of it's worth litigating, some of it's just bad theories. And
another one that's relevant to our podcast is that he was a big purveyor of the, what was her name? Candace Newmaker?
Yes, Candace Newmaker.
Yeah, MatPat's Petscop video kind of like brought the focus of a lot of people solely to Candace Newmaker, which I think was not the intention of Tony Petscop, as we have sort of found later, and kind of ruined the discussion space for a year or two after it came out.
Yeah. I will, as somebody who watched Petscop post that, like, after it had all come out, I am more forgiving of him on that now, mostly because, like, the Candace Newmaker stuff was there, and it wasn't intended to be the main focus in the way that he did, but, like, when you only have X amount of Petscop episodes, I understand focusing on it. However, the point you made of it kind of ruining discussion for the next year very much is the case. That was sort of MatPat making a video about something you care about kind of went from, you know, something really exciting to something that would make Mr. Incredible become uncanny.
Yeah, it's like, oh no.
Oh God, what bullshit is he gonna say? However, I will also say that as a person, I've heard nothing but good things. I've heard nothing but him being a cool dude. And, like, while we can sit here and litigate, you know, over a decade or so of his work, and we probably should, like, as a person, I have heard nothing but good things, and I have also heard nothing but him being very supportive about, you know, certain issues, TM. This is more, like, MatPat retiring feels like a new era. I saw a tweet that was like, this is the Gen Z equivalent of, what was it, Blue's Clues? Like, this is the equivalent of Joe taking over for Blue's Clues, which, one, I heard somebody immediately reply with, Gen Z was the Gen Z equivalent of Blue's Clues. But, like, honestly, it kind of feels apt of, like, you know, the channel's gonna be there, all four channels are gonna be there, but they're, you know, they're gonna be fundamentally different because the big guy is gone. And, you know, I'm willing to bet we're gonna look back on this and clearly see a different era of all the theory channels, but we're not going to suddenly miss the theory channels. They're all still here, and they're all still gonna be quite popular.
Yeah, I think for me, though, like, so Tom Scott makes great, very educational videos, often on very niche topics that are explained well and quick.
Yep. He went to the, I just wanted to shout out that he went to the, like, Kansas City landfill that has a bunch of the nuclear, or no, it's not the Kansas City landfill. It's the landfill, in, like, near St. Louis that has a bunch of nuclear waste. And he specifically talked about, like, you know, I was originally going to end this with, and then it all got cleaned up. Except that I ended up talking to locals, and it turns out, you know, not all of it did. And it also turns out that certain areas in St. Louis have higher predispositions towards cancer, and I think it's really interesting.
Like,
and
fluorescent. Wah, wah.
Yeah, like, completely based. Yeah. Tom Scott, I will never sully the reputation of.
I had no idea he made a video on the Westlake landfill.
Oh, yeah. He's made he has made a lot of videos on a lot of, like, landfills or, like, pit lakes. You know, yeah. Stuff that's like, you know, it may look very inviting, but you would not want to walk down this trail because the government set up a trail killer program in 1958.
You wouldn't want to drive by the landfill. That shit smells bad. Yeah. I have to take that all the time. It's so bad. Anyways. Yeah, I think the thing about Tom Scott is that he has gray hair. not a jab necessarily. But then he also had announced like a year or two ago that he wanted to retire and that the amount of like actual videos he was making was going to slow down or, you know, halt within a certain time frame.
Yeah.
So he kind of gave a heads up, and I think a lot of people had time to sort of like reckon with that. Whereas MatPat, it feels very sudden. At least from like someone who doesn't actively watch him anymore, it feels like this guy who's constantly been sort of a figure on certain parts of the internet has now just decided, hey, I'm kind of done with this. And like, I don't know, maybe this is the announcement, but it feels just really surprising. And I think that's why it's made out to be this big deal.
Yeah.
It feels from left field.
Yeah.
Another one I wanted to bring up is Jerma, who we've talked about a lot before in various things, but Jerma, for I think a year or two, has said that he's looking to retire from streaming in the next few years and move to a more like production side, director, creative consultant side for like larger event streams and like story driven streams.
Yeah.
Things like the Dollhouse, or I think like Generation Loss is something he had a lot of input on.
That would make sense.
Which won best live stream. And So yeah, like, I think that makes a lot of sense for him in his skill set and his existing sort of fan base and whatnot. But, like, I think Jerma retiring is now a known constant. So while it will be, you know, a little unfortunate to not have more Jerma streams, at the very least, like, we're prepared. It's weird because I feel like we're talking about a dead person. But so this is something I really thought about a lot when Adventure Time ended, because Adventure Time, like, I wasn't a baby when it first started airing on Cartoon Network. I mean, I remember seeing the pilot when I was a little kid, but like Adventure Time had been going for so long that it was almost like I almost grieved it when it ended. And obviously it's back now. It's still going on with like extra canon, you know, sequel stories and whatnot. So like, it's kind of dumb now to feel that way when like Simon and Marcy, or there was just like a Marceline story, I think. Anyways, or there's like the new Fiona and Cake. But like at the time, it felt like this is the end of something that I've taken for granted, that like I just assumed there would still be more Adventure Time in the future.
Yeah.
But now that there's not, and it's reached a definitive ending, it feels like something's gone.
This is kind of something I wanted to talk about with JoCat. And JoCat is a different situation. I'm not going to get into it. I'm not going to relitigate it or anything. But this is a pro JoCat podcast here. And
Pro-cat
podcast. And, like, something I was initially going to make a TikTok about, I might still make a TikTok about, was essentially bringing up, like, creators in the creator space, when they decide to stop creating for one reason or another, whether they're, you know, kind of kicked off the internet or whether they just sort of retire, as we've seen more and more, creators don't die. Unless they literally die, they're still there, and they're usually still kind of, like, in the vicinity. Like, I want to bring kind of a focus on, like, Anthony Padilla, for example, who left Smosh, which was a really big thing, but then went on to make his own channel and do other things. Or Lindsay Ellis, who, you know, took a step down from the public eye, but now keeps making things and putting them out on Nebula, which is, you know, a slightly more controlled space, and they're all still very good. And, like, with JoCat specifically, the point that I made was, like, JoCat has years of animating experience, drawing experience, social media experience, streaming experience. Like, JoeCat is going into some other industry. And it's probably going to be an industry where we will still, quote-unquote, see them. You know, I would be surprised if JoeCat 100% never, you know, showed up to any other con and never did anything in the animation industry and what have... Like, I guarantee you that, you know, Tom Scott, Jerma, JoeCat, they're still going to be present, just in a different capacity. You know, MatPat, I would be 100% surprised if he didn't, you know, kick out of retirement every now and again, like, what's up, internet? I'm gonna tell you why GTA 78 is actually about the 1948 attempted assassination of Herbert Hoover. Herbert Hoover, the secret 56th and a half president. Like, that's you know, that's probably what's going to happen. They're going to take a break for a good couple of years, and then they're gonna, you know, kind of come back, do something every now and again, and then go back down. This is usually how creators go, and ultimately we just kind of have to respect that we get free content out of creators. We kind of can't strictly be upset when they decide to just, when they decide to retire.
Yeah, everyone is human. Everyone needs to take a step back.
Except JoeCat. He's a cat.
Sure. Nothing is permanent, and that's okay.
Everything is true. Nothing is permitted. Wait.
It's interesting because, like, I think the nature of capital C content is to have it be continuous.
Yes.
And that's just sort of due to the way that systems have been sculpted. Like, to get money, you have to keep making videos because you keep making videos so that, you know, you'll be promoted through, like, the algorithm, or because people rely on a regular stream and they'll forget about you or get bored if you stop for too long.
Yep.
Taking breaks is pretty heavily discouraged by, like, the systems involved in promoting things. I don't want to say the algorithm, because that sometimes used like a boogeyman.
Yes.
but a mix of both, like, psychology, conditioning, and, like, promotion and stuff like that, and marketing, all causes it to be very heavily reliant on continual updates. And that's what, like, if you were to go to, like, a How to Be a YouTuber 101 class or something, usually one of the first things you hear is be consistent.
Yes. Yeah.
But, like, you can get that so lost in your head that you forget that people take breaks from work sometimes. Like I know that's sort of a big thing. And if you can't take breaks from work, buddy, union, like you gotta have breaks.
Yeah. You gotta talk to someone about that. The ideally your coworkers.
And, like, content creation seems like a cushy job, but it's still a job and it's still work.
Oh yeah.
I kind of hate the thing of, like, you know, do what you love and you'll never work a day in your life.
Bullshit!
Because, yeah, that's an unhealthy way to treat labor, especially something you do for others and not purely for your own, like, self-actualization.
Yeah.
Like, I can write something for me to read and nobody else and, like, dig it in my backyard or something, but the moment I put it out there for other people, I am now beholden to so many other factors.
Yeah.
And that puts on pressure and stress and, like, you're not immune to stress, buddy.
Jack Saint has recently kind of come back, I'm going to heavy air quotes, after a pretty long hiatus. And a lot of the things that he focuses on kind of are how the process of making online content is itself extremely taxing. A lot of times because of these systems, because of, like, the you know, the social obligation, the, like, psychological aspect of, if I don't have a video out about fucking Willy Wonka, you know, or the new Prince of Persia or whatever the hell, like, then, you know, I'm wasting time. I should be putting out content. And also just sort of the, you know, the toll it puts on you mentally to have to, like, record, film, and, you know, put out a consistent video, like, twice every month or once every month. It's a lot. And so it really does make a lot of sense that, you know, after over a decade for so many of these creators, they're just like, you know, I have, like, a family and a kid, and I have a life outside of content creation. I'd like to spend time with that.
Yeah. So part of why we are sort of changing our system here is that, at least for me, I can't speak for Galen because we're different people, but at least for me, from like my experience, I have been sort of downplaying the amount of work it actually takes for me to put out an episode of NetSurfer Pro. Like, I'm currently focusing on both my words and the waveforms of my speech as I turn my volume knob. You know, I don't want to have the gain too high, but I don't want to have it too low. And that is just one part of the job. And so, like, making these sorts of episodes every week alongside having to, like, prepare and research and stuff has been way more taxing than I really gave it credit for.
Yeah.
And only after, like, taking a break for a bit did I realize I should probably, like, find a better way to manage my time.
Yeah.
I haven't had, like, time to pursue other interests as much, or other projects, or, like, develop skills. And so I think, like, it's easy to get into this feeling of like, oh, I'm just talking into a microphone, so surely it's not that hard, right? But then I think about it, and I'm like, I'm kind of overworking myself in some regards.
Yeah, it's, you know, like, editing a podcast is one of the, I'm going to say, less intensive, you know, aspects of, like, content creation or, you know, creating something creatively. And it is still
way to downplay me.
It's less intensive than like an entire video, but it's still multiple hours of content usually that you have to scrabble through or just listen all the way through and actively edit down, you know, parts. It's like there's an amount of, you know, directorial control. There's the simple aspect of having to sit in front of hours of audio and usually re-listen a couple of times. Like, mm-hmm. you know, this is all difficult, and we often kind of forget about that when we're on the other side, when we're just watching the videos, that, like, this takes a lot of work and a lot of time and a lot of effort.
Well, I don't mean even just from the audience, but me, myself.
Yeah.
I underestimated the amount of effort I was currently doing. It's not that, like, I went into this expecting low effort, because I kind of did, but I also, like, you know, this podcast we've been doing for 3.5 or so years, 3 to 4, I don't really know. We started at a weird time anyways. And then even before that, I had already been doing like Board Game Bros for 3 or 4 years. Again, I don't remember. In that whole time, I hadn't really thought about or reflected upon the amount of work I was doing.
Yeah.
So the moral of the story is, you know, go to therapy, talk to a therapist, and maybe you'll come to some conclusions. Yeah.
Men will literally do a 2-hour long podcast instead of going to therapy.
Well, good thing I'm only sort of a man. True. And so I only sort of did a 2-hour long podcast and then I went to therapy. You know how it is.
Yeah. Oh, that just peaked the microphone. That's going to be fun to edit.
Yeah, exactly. Asshole. Downplaying low effort of the media. Anyways, so I was going to mention, so Billiam of the channel Billiam.
Yes.
You know, Billiam.
To go from YouTubers who are retiring to YouTubers who are active.
Yeah, so Billiam just like a week ago released the 5th installment of his Lost analysis.
I believe it's the 3rd.
I don't know. However, he talks about Lost Season 5, as well as the, like, extracurricular, extra-textual content, like the ARG, spin-off novels, the video game, you know, all the extra, like, Lost spin-offs and stuff. And, as always, it's a great, like, critical dive. It's a good recap. He goes over a ton of themes and references. It goes over a lot of the historical figures that are referenced by, like, character names and locations and what those mean for, like, the themes and the symbolism of Lost. Very great work. But I kind of wanted to bring this up because a big point that he hammers home in the first Lost video, I wanted to bring it up because it's an early frontrunner for Best Longest, but a point he makes in his first Lost video is that he didn't really know how the video would be received. In that the project was, like, more or less a self-indulgent project. And luckily it was received well, and that sort of gave him confidence. But you can tell through a lot of the, like, skits between segments that this plays, like, a major part. And even then, the skits in that first video, relate a lot to him overworking himself.
Yeah.
And, like, realizing that he needed to better pace his content and output in order to make something he was happy with while still being happy. And so, like, watching that newest one and then going back to see that first part, I was really sort of empathizing with it, and also just thought it was a really good thing to bring up here.
Yeah. I would like to bring up briefly The Ballad of John and Yoko.
Yeah.
I mentioned it before, and the reason that I want to bring it up is that, one, it is relevant, but two, it is... Gosh, I'm genuinely sad that it, like, came out right after the Net Surfies, because it would have been on Best Longest as a contender.
Or Best
Edited.
Yeah,
Best Longest or Best Edited. It is so good. If you have a Nebula account or can bum a Nebula account off of a friend, watch it. Super duper recommend. But it's, you know, it is kind of relevant in that it is, you know, a more deadly version of The Perils of Fame. It's The Perils of Fame when, you know, it's literally lethal, given that,
yeah,
Lindsay Ellis put out a brief, like, the first part for free on her YouTube channel, and it is explicitly about John Lennon's death and, like, Yoko Ono's sort of, not reaction to it, but, like, how terrible it must have been for Yoko during that time, considering absolutely everyone was kind of against her, except for, like, literally the other Beatles.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of, that's what the first part of the video is about, but each chapter really has its own identity and brings up other, like, arguments and has other statements to make.
Yes.
Chapter 3, I'm not going to go into it right now, but it is a culmination of a lot of thoughts I've had for quite a while.
Chapter, I want to say 6, you know the chapter if you've seen it. I believe it might have been 5, actually. It's the Lee Harvey Oswald chapter.
Yeah.
Is, like, legitimately just 10 minutes of my favorite, like, content, capital C content, I've seen ever. It is so incredibly good and has primarily disproven any and all JFK conspiracies for me. Like, yeah. The Ballad of John and Yoko is a wonderful video because each part kind of acts as its own, you know, paragraph, its own thesis statement over the whole of it. It's about John Lennon and the Beatles and Yoko Ono. It's about disproving that Yoko Ono broke up the Beatles, heavy air quotes. It's also about, you know, the legacy of it, and the, you know, the legacy of the Beatles themselves. It's about, like, you know, if you, like, who do you really blame for the Beatles breaking up? It's about the Beatles as a band. Like, it is about so much, but the fact that it is structured where, you know, each individual part kind of has its own conclusion, its own thesis that it is trying to put forward to a greater whole. It felt kind of Dan Olsen-ish, honestly, which is... I hate that I'm describing one creator with another creator, but, like, it's
literary.
Yeah.
In that, like, when you read a book that is a critical book over a work or, like, a band, you're not expecting each chapter to fall under the same thesis statement. Each chapter is a unique chapter, and thus it opens with a different thesis statement or ends with a different conclusion tied together by the bindings of the book and the concept behind it. But, like, you know, you're not going to have a 50-page, even, you know, that large book about one topic.
Yeah.
As far as, like, covering something else.
Yeah. It is, yeah, it has my full recommendation. Again, would have gone on, like, Best Edited if it had come out literally 1 week before. And so, yeah, if you get the chance to watch it, please do. It's wonderful.
Also, great use of music. Obviously, it uses Beatles music, but, like, the music choices are great.
Yes, it uses them to incredible effect. But that's enough of looking in the past. Why don't we look in the past slightly different? That's right.
Okay.
Video games.
Yeah. So this is essentially just two video games that we want to talk about that we didn't talk about on the Net Surfies for very specific reasons. Let's start with you and your reason for your crime.
Yes. So Starfield came out in the year of our Lord 2023, and I had...
It did!
I know. I had nothing to say about it. That was pretty much the reaction from a lot of people, actually. Starfield... I'm gonna keep this brief, because Starfield is a game that was meant to be, you know, the next big Bethesda, like, IP, essentially. It's Fallout 4, but in an original, you know, space setting. It's, you know, the Skyrim of the stars. And it's just kind of... I have very little to say about Starfield, having sunk a good couple of hours into it. I didn't sink any hours into it, like, myself. I had a Game Pass briefly, and so I got to play it for a month. And so, you know, I essentially got it for free and had access to it for free. It is such a 7 out of 10 game. I legitimately do not understand why Todd Howard looked upset at the Game Awards. Like,
7 out of 10, Omega Lol.
It really is. Like... It is... Okay, I have kind of come around on Skyrim. Skyrim is my least favorite game. It is the lowest on my favorite list, explicitly so that my Sims can be one above it. But I still consider it a great game. It finally clicked for me with the DLCs. But I understand Skyrim's point. Skyrim essentially is a, like, a GM-less... like RPG. It is it is quite generic, but it is essentially the best, like, you know, it lends itself well to self-directed role-playing. You know, it lends itself well to downloading a mod that lets you start in 7 different locations and deciding, you know what, I'm gonna be a Khajiit Warhammer user, why not? And then, you know, you click a mob that's like, you start in this town with some money. And, like, that is fun. It places you in a world that's moderately interesting, but interesting enough to actively get you engaged in it. And then it kind of just asks you to, you know, build whatever you want. You can do basically anything in one character. Starfield is a similar situation. Like, there's a lot of traits that, like, give you little things that are kind of interesting. There's a trait that gives you a house, but you also have a home loan. There's a trait that gives you parents, but you, like, lose 2% of you know, credits or what have you. And the parents are, you know, real characters you can go and meet. There's various traits that make you citizens of the different domains that I obviously didn't pick because it was my first time playing.
I like the number one fan.
Yeah, the number one fan is also really good. I do quite like the number one fan, especially as a throwback to Oblivion, of course. But, like, the problem is that it has all of these functions. It has this functionality. I could have found a random planet, built a random house, and decided to just live there for the entire time. But why would I? Why would I is the question I asked myself constantly in Skyrim. And... at a certain point, it didn't have an answer, but there were certain answers it did finally have. Like, I could become the archmage of the college, but why would I? Well, it gives you access to a nice room that has a lot of, you know, reusable materials that are all alchemy-based. That is literally at least one tangible benefit. I can also then, you know, sell the Elder Scrolls to the librarian. That's a tangible benefit. And so, like... It's not just the tangible benefits, it's the fact that it also kind of positions it in a roleplay sense. And I just... Starfield is not a worthwhile world to be in. It has everything. It has base building, it has the loot system, it has decent enough guns that I don't care that they don't work like real guns. They look fine. It has a, you know, a vaguely interesting aesthetic, but it's very generic and NASA punk. Like, it's the most inoffensive possible, like, you know, sci-fi imagination you could have at Bethesda, I assume.
I like NASA punk.
I like NASA punk too. Like, I legit...
That's why the moon base is the best Overwatch stage. Don't at me. It has a rock climbing wall.
You know, that's fair.
And a hydroponics garden. What else do you want?
This is why Moonbase Alpha is my favorite game.
John Madden.
Hey, yeah. Like, Nassapunk is good. I like the aesthetic, but I also kind of like look at it and go, like, you could have done more interesting things here and you made an active choice not to. It's, you know, the people you're fighting are spacers. The, you know, you're going around and getting into dogfights every now and again, but it's really just like a random thing that occasionally stops you from your objective. It's not like a whole thing. There's a million quests in the world, but, you know, unless you find the Radiant quests of Oblivion particularly interesting, none of them are like really gonna grip you and tell a amazingly deep story. Like, the main quest is about, like, oh, you find, you know, an artifact that hints that there might be intelligent life out there. And it's like, you know, okay, sure, in a human-only setting, I'm sure that is exciting. And I understand the excitement here, but I am not personally excited to, like, go find a bunch of biscuits and maybe get, like, a high from an alien. Like, it throws everything at the wall, and so little of it actually stuck for me that I legitimately was just like, how did they make this game and expect this to be the next big thing? It is exceedingly generic.
So here's I think there's a few things to keep in mind here. Zero, I have not played Starfield. I've seen a lot of it, but I haven't played it. So, you know, take this with a grain of salt, what have you. These are just opinions. But for one, No Man's Sky exists. For two, Baldur's Gate 3 exists. For three, Skyrim has mods.
Yeah. Yeah.
Those are, I think, the three things that contribute to this game's reception. No Man's Sky has things like the space, like, liftoff. You can leave the atmosphere in No Man's Sky. You can't do that in Starfield. You can also do that in Outer Wilds, and that was a game made by, like, 10 people, so, like, or even less than that.
Yeah.
So, like, that, I think, is one thing that is causing people to be upset with it, is that it feels like there are expectations that are set by the elevator pitch that aren't really met, and that also makes people more critical of a lot of the other Bethesda-isms.
Yeah.
And then, two, Starfield as a role-playing game doesn't feel as captivating as something like Baldur's Gate 3, which had a very long development time as well, but, like, I don't know. I think the choices in Starfield don't feel as interesting, or they don't feel like you have as much agency. And, like, there are characters you can kill in Baldur's Gate 3 who are important, but they do the Bethesda thing in Starfield where you can't kill a lot of important NPCs.
Yeah.
Or at least, you know, that's what they've been doing in recent games. And so, like, that makes it feel like the player doesn't have as much room to really express themselves or flex themselves. And in a role-playing game where you are trying to create a character concept and then role-play as that character, not role-playing game as, like, use stats to fight bad guys. I mean, like, role-playing as, like, actual improv role-play, character work.
Yeah.
In those types of games, it really matters the limits to how you express yourself, especially when there is a story involved. Because that sets the boundaries for what the player is allowed to do and what kind of characters they're allowed to make. And that then sets the boundaries for, like, you know, what the player's options are. It is, like, implicit option or explicit options in terms of, like, dialogue or quest progression lead to implicit inherited options for character creation.
Yeah.
Like, if I want to make a bandit or just a real scumbag of a guy, how does that impact my playthrough compared to the righteous paladin?
Yeah, there's a part in Skyrim that I always remember where you walk into Windhelm, the racist place, and there's, you know, some Nords who are like, eh, Dark Elf, blah, blah, blah. And then the Dark Elf turns to you and is like, man, those guys, are you racist like them? And your options are, yes, I'm racist, and no, I'm not racist. And I make fun of it because, you know, it's a very funny way to portray this. But literally, at least that gives you the option to be a dick. Like, at least the options here, I as a person can, you know, play a fucking Khajiit and be like, you know, yes, I am racist. And in my head, I transpose that with, like, you know, my character being like, get away from me, dark elf. Like, I understand the genericness there because at the very least, you know, there is room for you to kind of editorialize. There is very little room for you to editorialize, especially when you just don't really have a lot of engaging choices and don't really have a really engaging world to engage in those choices with.
Yeah. And then the last part was that, like, so people were going to make a Starfield Together mod.
Yep.
There's Skyrim Together, which allows you to play Skyrim multiplayer. They were going to do that for Starfield, and they decided to scrap it because the game is too boring.
Yep.
There is a real effect of modding kind of causing complacency or, like, buy-in, where people who play a lot of modded games or play one game modded a lot kind of have so much time and interest invested in that game that it's hard to pull them away from it at times. And I think that's especially the case with these massive Bethesda games that really take a lot of, like, coercion to sort of get you to sit down and get into the world sometimes.
Yeah.
But so with Starfield not having a legacy world like Fallout or Elder Scrolls that people already like, they have to work really hard and make the best game ever so that people don't just play modded Skyrim, which has a ton of features that make it better to roleplay or better mechanically.
And they just assumed that they didn't have to. They just assumed if they make, you know, another Bethesda game, but this time it's in space and has marginally more interesting things to do, that'll, you know, sort itself out and then the community will build everything around it. And turns out that just doesn't happen when you make a game that's the most 7 out of 10 game ever.
Yeah. Like, I think the traits being more built around, like, the traits being like character prompts almost, like you have parents or you have a house with a home loan. Those are interesting because they kind of encourage the player to think about what this means for the character rather than what this means for themselves. But then also, it still has mechanical elements in, like, RPG stuff, but it also doesn't really go into them super hard. And, oh wait, I'm describing Cyberpunk, aren't I?
I met my parents once in the game, and I was not impressed. They are very, very generic parents, just like, oh my god, you know, well, we support you forever, that you're part of this, you know, cool expedition force. We're just gonna bum around them now. Bye!
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I think I've exhausted every single thing I have, every single opinion I have about Starfield, and I'm really ready to never think about it again.
Yep. Just like Star Wars. Now let's go to a good game. So, this
Star
is
Trek! Star Trek is my favorite game.
So this is a game that came out last year, and it would have been on Indie Game of the Year shortlist, but I did not play it until this year, because I bought it during the Steam Winter Sale. But I want to talk about Chants of Sennar. Huge spoilers, because this is a, like, puzzle adventure game. Sort of the whole point is learning about it. So, okay, so spoiler warning is now in effect for Chants of Sennar. So it is a game about learning languages. It has this, like, Tower of Babel sort of setup, where there's this big labyrinthine city that you eventually learn is, like, several cities stacked on top of each other of varying technological complexity and, like, social changes. And you start out in, like, the very lowest level, which is very sort of Sumerian, Egyptian inspired, probably more Mesopotamian or Sumerian. And you don't know what people are saying, but you can infer from context clues what they're trying to get you to do. And through this, you eventually start to decipher their language. And so that, like, it'll show, like, two glyphs and you don't know what they do, but the person will point somewhere. So you can click on that glyph in your journal and write down, like, this could mean move or go or there. And then you come to a door, and the door has a, like, switch next to it with two glyphs on it. And when you hit the switch one way, it opens, and when you do it the other way, it closes. So then you're like, oh, so this could mean open, this could mean close, it could mean on and off. They're opposites, but that's roughly what they mean. And then when you're able to, so your journal has every glyph, and then it has, like, pictograms referring to what they could define. When you match the glyph to the pictogram in groups of three, much like Oberdin, for example, it tells you what the actual meaning is. So through this way, you will then start to be able to read full text translated automatically to your language.
Oh, that's cool.
And at first I was like, okay, so there's one civilization with one language. That's cool. Kind of makes you think of like Tunic or La Mulana, but a bit more involved. But it seems kind of small if you look at the amount of pictograms. Oops, there's actually like 5 different languages in this game that you have to learn. Each one slightly more complex than the other.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, so there's like the devotees. And then above them, in terms of both like power and hierarchy and actual like location in the tower, are the warriors. And the warriors have like different glyphs that are similar in definition. And some of these involve taking the glyphs from one language and matching them directly to a glyph in another instead of matching it to a picture.
Oh.
Yeah. And then after them, you have the like the artisans. And the artisans have their own language, and then you have the scientists, and then after the scientists are like the exiles. So you have a few different civilizations, each with their own unique style. So the devotees have a very like carved, almost Sanskrit interpretation. The warriors kind of remind me of Greek or Cyrillic in some ways, but not really. They're just very like jagged lines, whereas the devotees have more curves.
Yeah.
And the lines are more evenly spaced, whereas the devotees can be kind of widened and narrowed at weird times. Then the artisans are like Arabic. And then the scientists have theirs based off of alchemy. So all their glyphs are like circles with lines and nodes attached, like graphs.
Yo, that's
cool. So that's really cool. They each have their own identity. You learn how their societies work. There are some stealth sections that are really bad, and I feel like they didn't need to be in the game for the game to be effective. And it's weird, because, like, the first stealth section is a literal avoid line of sight. It's just like the guards in Ocarina of Time when you're sneaking into the castle. But then, like, the next one is more of a social stealth, where you are trying to blend in with the customs of the people around you. And that makes way more sense for this concept, because as you learn about the language, you learn about the customs, the traditions, the rituals, the, like, relation between different peoples and how there's a sort of caste hierarchy. And ultimately, your goal is to translate from one language to another, complete conversations, acting as a diplomat, a translator between groups.
That's awesome.
That's all cool. My favorite thing, though, is the interesting dumb linguistic side of this. So, for example, the devotees, they define plurals by having multiple of their noun in the same, in like a row. So plants is plant, plant, in terms of the way the glyphs are written out.
Yeah.
Then, like, a lot of the later ones will have a plural notator. The warriors have, like, many as a word, so you do many plants. But then the artisans have punctuation, and the punctuation defines plurals. And so, like, it manifests not just in terms of different words and different ways to spell, but in different syntax as well.
Yeah, it's not just, like, translating Germanic languages. It is translating, you know, entire language styles, essentially. Yeah,
but then there's other unspoken rules that are not actually relevant to translating that, like, you can complete the game without ever really paying attention to. For example, there is plant and garden. In the, like, devotee language, garden is a box around plant. And then there is death in graveyard, and graveyard is a box around the word death. For death.
Yeah.
Indicating that they have a glyph that represents, like, a location or a building for the purpose of whatever is inside of it. And so, like, there are these compound glyphs that combine two separate things together to create one, and that's never brought to your attention directly. You don't see the separate, like, building glyph. That just doesn't exist. But I noticed that as, like, oh, these all mean, like, place for something, so they have a way to distinguish a place as, like, a square. Or, like, the warriors are very representative in their glyphs because they're based off constellations, and the constellations are based off images, you know, like constellations tend to be.
Yep.
So, like, there is a part where you literally decipher glyphs based on their constellation. The way they represent, like, demon is a like stick figure guy who's really angry, but also they use that same thing for the devotees because they hate the devotees. It's not actually demon, it's like impure or
bad guy.
Yeah, but they use that for both the devotees and the literal monsters that exist. So then you get into the bit of how language impacts the way that they philosophically view the world, and you get into how that in turn educates their language.
Oh, that's cool.
Interesting. I really want to do like a video or something on it, specifically going over the linguistics and not the themes of the game, because the themes are kind of basic. It's like, there is like a phone bad bit towards the end, which I kind of hate. But it is ultimately that like language is a barrier that when enforced acts as any other barrier, that it is a wall or a gate that must be opened by translation in order to further people for the better.
Yeah.
And I think that's like a cool message, but it is also very blatant. The Tower of Babel theme in sort of symbol is very clear early on.
It makes sense. Like, it makes sense ultimately, especially if, you know, with a game that is about translation. Like, I suppose that, you know, thematically, it kind of gets the point across with the gameplay is more the point, you know, of like the linguistics being the focus kind of informs the theme in a way that you sort of get. Inherently,
it's not bad for a theme to be on its sleeve. Like, one of my favorite games is Jimmy and the Pulsating Mass, which is incredibly upfront about what it's about, such that like by the ending, which in any other game would be a like secret twist reveal a la Fight Club, it's like, oh yeah, sure, yeah, that, I see, I understand. But then like being able to reconcile that very early on then allows you to focus on other things, which is helpful, yeah. I think. I just wish there weren't so many stealth sections. There's one in particular that I had to spend way too long on, because the sight lines were very unclear, and there was, like, timing involved. God. And, like, this isn't even the only game I've played like this. I think The Last Campfire had some bullshit like this. Like, just make an adventure game. You don't need stealth sections. Just, like, just make the adventure. Have some confidence.
Yeah.
If you're going to make this cool puzzle game about, like, learning things, and you're not going to fully develop the systems a la La Mulana, which is, like, equally riddle puzzles and Metroidvania, then just, like, stick to the puzzles if that's what you want to do. Or, you know, make it better for the player to do the stealth sections. It's like in Talos Principle when you get shot to death. Like, why am I getting shot to death?
I'm reminded constantly of the LA Noir sections where you have to shoot. Because it's a you know, Rockstar game, and we have the gunplay, so we might as well do it. And so it's, you know, this really downbeat detective game about picking up coffee cups and going like, oh, there's lipstick marks on it. And then suddenly, you know, somebody bursts through a door or whatever, and you just mow down 50 people. And it's like, I feel like they should have just had more confidence here and been like, no, you don't get into shootouts, or at least it doesn't happen every mission.
Yeah. But it's a good game. I recommend checking it out.
Honestly, I'm more interested in it now than you've described it.
There is one thing that I haven't gone back to that I want to, which is that in the scientist section, there is a paper for like a formula that is untranslatable, as in it doesn't auto-translate. For most text, you can hover over the text, and if you've completed the glyphs, it'll show you just the plain text translation. But not this one picture. However, this paper is a bespoke scene. Like, when you click on it, it shows you the paper up close.
Yeah.
And no other information in that scene is relevant. So I'm over here like, is this a fez thing?
Is this a quick brown fox jumping over a lazy dog here?
Well, I mean, the game is the quick brown fox.
But I'm making specific reference to the fez thing.
Yeah, is this the Squeakrit ARG that we're supposed to find? I don't know. I want to go back to it, though, because it does use glyphs that you should be able to recognize.
You know what I want to go back to, though? I want to go back to
the future?
Yeah, I want to go back to the future, which is to say now, because the future is now, because we are going to look 2024 word. That's right.
Nice.
Thanks.
Plus two.
Aw, I got two now. I can spend them however I wish. And one of them that I'm going to spend on, the one that I'm going to talk about more briefly, is Broken Reality 2000.
I actually didn't know this was coming out until we were planning this episode, and Galen said he wanted to talk about Broken Reality 2000.
Yeah, I think I got back on a very brief Broken Reality kick. I just kind of, you know, wanted to watch a bunch of videos that were like, hey, explain this to me and I'll see if I agree with you or not. But yeah, Broken Reality 2000, it's a thing. It's coming out. I don't have a specific date because I don't know that they have a specific date just yet. I believe it's early 2024. But yeah, it's much like Hypnospace Outlaw, the sequel, which I can't remember the name of.
Dream Settlers?
Yeah. It seems like Broken Reality 2000 is essentially doing something very similar, where instead of the very 90s aspect, it's a little more like 2000s. I mean, GeoCities was in the original, I suppose. But like, it seems to be, you know, a little more 2000-centric, a little more like, you know, spinning 3D objects in a strange water world, very vaporwave still, very inspired by the internet. I don't know that we know anything about, like, the plot and stuff, but I'm really interested to see it, especially considering Broken Reality kind of had an ending, so I don't know what's happening here.
Yeah, Broken Reality had a very finite ending.
Yeah, it had an ending where you turn things off and everybody dances.
And then you go into like a non-Euclidean universe.
Yeah.
And your sister is there. So, yeah, that part confused me. I am very interested, though. I mean, we did episodes on both Hypnospace and Broken Reality. I love vaporwave stuff, and I think video games are kind of the perfect realm for it because it allows you to explore these like retro 3D worlds.
Yep.
And so much of vaporwave as an identity is based on 3D renders that like it makes sense, you know.
Yeah.
And I like Broken Reality, so I'm excited for it. I like that the Steam page description says 50% less problematic memes, because that's like maybe the one thing that makes it hard to recommend.
Yeah.
It's a little too 4chan at times.
Yeah. Broken Reality, I personally defend it. I will still say that, yeah. It has some 4chan sensibilities that are like, yeah, if you want to make an analysis here, I would absolutely say, yeah, this hasn't aged well and probably could do without.
Yeah, like, I mean, go back to our episode to listen to that,
yeah,
about it if you're more interested.
Not going to go too depth into it. I'm just excited for the new one.
Now, here's what I want to know. Will it be a good speed game? Because the first game is a great speed game. I've did some runs. I don't think I ever submitted one because there was like one trick that I had trouble getting. It was you can launch yourself with the soda cans in the like Night City area, the fourth level.
Yeah, the GeoCities.
Yeah, I think that's what it was called. But like one of my favorite things is that the bookmark ability, which allows you to like save a checkpoint and then reload it. When it creates the bookmark slightly above the ground, so when you reload it, you're in the air slightly. So you could actually fly by mashing create bookmark and then reload bookmark. However, you have to open and close your menu in between it. So it's like click, tab, tab, click, tab, tab, click, tab, tab, click over and over again.
Yeah.
But it allows you to do things like clip through ceilings, and then you can get launched through ceilings. And it does that to leave the first level, Domo Paradiso, without getting any items other than the bookmark, because then you get all of them when you leave because you're expected to have them all. So, like, I hope it has room for weird sequence breaks like that.
Yeah, I hope that they've kept it. I imagine they would. I imagine that not knowing the dev personally, I imagine that they understand that adds just sort of more fun and replayability.
Mm-hmm.
Add a few more syllables in there. Yeah, I'm excited for it. I hope that there's not a ship engine section, because the ship engine section was the worst section gameplay-wise.
Yep, the ship engine section was the worst. You skip that in the speed run.
Yeah, as you should.
If you're doing all golden triangles, I think you're able to go backwards through it, which is to say downwards.
Yeah, I know that there's like one or two down there, but yeah.
Yeah, but for the main speed run, you essentially go through the back door using a combination of different techniques.
Based.
And that allows you to go straight to the deck of the ship.
Based. Is there anything you're looking forward to in 2024?
So there are two things I wanted to shout out, but we're kind of running out of time, so I'll only shout out one. which is that, so Stern has shown a lot of footage of their next table, their next pinball table. It's Jaws, and it looks pretty good. It's a new Keith Elwin table, and Keith Elwin is like one of the best designers right now. He made Jurassic Park for Stern. He was the designer for Godzilla. So like, those are two top 10 tables, yeah, arguably. Especially Godzilla.
Godzilla, I was about to say, Godzilla you've talked about multiple times.
It's maybe it's goated. I can say that much. For more information, check out my stream VODs where I recently did a pinball tier list. But so that already is a good start. It looks really good. The graphic design's great. It has a lot of light blues and some like orange browns to contrast. So it looks pretty colorful and eye-catching. I don't know. I'll play anything Keith Elwin puts out, and I'm pretty much guaranteed to find it because Stern is the moneymakers. They're like the standard of quality. They're pretty much guaranteed to be in most arcades, if not every arcade.
Yeah.
So I'll definitely be able to play it when it comes out.
And you know what else you'll be able to do when it comes out? Listen to this episode. NetSurfer Pro.
Yeah. You can follow us on any podcasting platform you like. Give us a like, give us a rating, give us a review. Let us know how we're doing. Let us know what topics you want to see us cover or just what you think we might like. You can also follow us at Twitter or Blue Sky at NetSurfer Pro, where we release teasers for upcoming updates or upcoming episodes, rather, as well as just, post about things that are coming up and post new episodes. And you can contact us there as well, of course. You can follow me on Twitter at Twackaroo or on Blue Sky at Twack, where I post mainly pinball high scores and other things I think of and things I'm working on. You can follow my stream on twitch.tv/twack, and you can follow my VODs at Twack's VODs and Ends on YouTube if you want to see old streams.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As for myself, you can find me on TikTok, you can find me on Twitter, and you can find me on Blue Sky, all of which at Galen Wilson. That's at GALENWILS0N. I post my hot takes and occasionally videos of my cat. You can find me on YouTube at The Only Galen on YouTube, and you can find me at Twitch at twitch.tv/machinegunvampire, where at the very least I know we're probably, like you said, we're probably going to be streaming Pal World co-op.
Yep.
But until that point, thank you very much for listening to this episode of Talk Surfer Show.
Time for us to retire.
Like
for the night, not permanently.
Yes.
Just like very briefly, you know what I mean. Yeah. Anyways, gotta go.
Gotta blast.